Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Greetings and welcome to this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, we look ahead to the great feast of the Epiphany this Sunday. Why interfaith dialogue will be high on the agenda over the coming months here in the Vatican. And we go over to Australia to hear how the National Council of Churches there is helping to promote practical paths of dialogue between people of different faiths. After all these celebrations of Christmas and New Year, Pope Benedict is enjoying a few quieter days here in the Vatican this week. On Sunday, however, he'll be presiding at Mass in St. Peter's Basilica to mark the Feast of the Epiphany. That Mass begins at 10 a.m. and is followed by the traditional recitation of the Angelus with pilgrims in St. Peter's Square. The word epiphany means revelation or manifestation, in this case of the divine nature of the infant Jesus to the wise men from the East. And this feast, less than 2 weeks after we celebrate the birth of Jesus in Bethlehem, already looks forward to other events in the life and mission of Christ the Messiah. My colleague Susie Hodges talked to Father Stephen Pisano, rector of the Pontifical Biblical Institute here in Rome, about the significance of this great feast of the Epiphany.
Well, of course, the main significance of this feast is the manifestation of Jesus to the Magi, who came from the East and saw the star and then came to Jerusalem and inquired of Herod about the newborn king of the Jews, and then the star directs them to Bethlehem, and then they come and worship the child Jesus and bring their gift of gold, frankincense, and myrrh. This is the basic part of the gospel account as we read in Matthew's gospel.
Of course, when they did this, they also alerted King Herod to the presence, the birth of Jesus, because we read that he was troubled by this news.
Yes, that's right. Herod, of course, was disturbed by this news and saw a rival in the fact that there was a newborn king of the Jews. So he asked the Magi to go and get information about the child and then come back and tell him. But, of course, as we know from the gospel story, after the Magi went and adored the child Jesus, then they were told in a dream not to return to Herod, and so they went back to their own country by another route. So Herod was foiled in his plans, and that, of course, then led to his violent reaction against all the newborn children in Bethlehem.
We're told that the Magi came from the East, but do we have any clue exactly where? I mean, some reports say Babylon.
We don't really know where they came from. And I think the fact that they came from the East is mainly an indication of the fact that they themselves were not Jews, but they came from the East, that is, from a pagan land. And the basic theological significance of that is the recognition of the true identity of Jesus by the pagans, that these non-Jewish wise men came to worship his newborn king. This was the first time that there was recognition beyond the borders of Israel of who Jesus was, because the first announcement of his birth, of course, was to the shepherds there near Bethlehem.
Going back to the Magi, who had told them that a star should announce the birth of the Messiah? I mean, the roots for this are found in the Old Testament, aren't they?
Well, yes, the fact that although it's not specifically said in the Old Testament that these wise men would come from the East necessarily, but the fact of the star does have roots in the Old Testament, and it is a sign, ultimately, of the coming of the Messiah.
Coming back to the Feast of the Epiphany, it's celebrated in different ways, sometimes even with different dates, isn't it? Or has been, at least in the past?
Well, yes. The precise date is not indicated in the Gospel account itself, but traditionally it is about 2 weeks after the birth of Jesus. And I suppose that especially in the English tradition, it's called the 12th day of Christmas. You know, you have sort of the traditional 12 days of Christmas, the first day being Christmas Day itself, and then the 12th day being the Feast of the Epiphany.
There's also the link to the baptism of Jesus, isn't there, when we consider the Epiphany?
Well, actually, there are several links. If you look at, for example, in the Holy Office, to the evening prayer, the antiphon for the Canticle of Mary says, three mysteries mark this holy day. Today the star leads the Magi to the infant Christ. Today water is changed into wine for the wedding feast. Today Christ wills to be baptized by John in the River Jordan to bring us salvation. So this idea of manifestation is linked to these three events in the life of Jesus. The coming of the Magi, the changing of water into wine at the wedding feast of Cana, and the baptism of Christ. And each of these, of course, has its own specific theological significance.
My thanks to Father Stephen Pisano there, rector of the Pontifical Biblical Institute, talking to my colleague Susie Hodges. Looking ahead now to issues which are likely to be making news here in the Vatican and in churches around the globe, dialogue with the Muslim world is expected to be high on that agenda over the coming months. In an interview with Vatican Radio this past week, the head of the Pontifical Council for Interreligious Dialogue, French Cardinal Jean-Louis Thauron, said a forthcoming meeting between Pope Benedict and a delegation of Muslim scholars would be a historic occasion, confirming comments he made to me recently that interfaith dialogue remains a priority of this pontificate.
The Holy Father said once during his first visit, pastoral visit to Germany, that that interreligious dialogue, especially with Islam, is not something incidental. It's an option, it's a necessity, and it's a question of survival for humanity. So dialogue is, I think, one of the priorities of this pontificate.
Following a letter written by 138 Muslim scholars to the Pope and other Christian leaders last October, the Vatican has responded with an invitation for a delegation of those Muslim leaders to be received by the Pope and to hold talks with other institutes such as the Gregorian University and the Pontifical Institute for Arabic and Islamic Studies. Cardinal Thauron told me the talks will be based on the important and positive developments raised by the message from so many leading Muslim scholars.
This message contains very new, very important elements. For example, that when the document speaks about Jesus, he's presented with quotation from the Gospel, from the New Testament, and this is very new, not from the Quran, but from our New Testament. So it's a kind of manifestation of respect towards the Christians. And there is also the awareness of the potential of peace, which is contained in religions. When they say that Muslims and Christians represent 50% of the world population, so it means that 50% of the world population is capable to contribute to the promotion of peace. So I think this is very important elements that we have to be answered to.
Cardinal Jean-Louis Thauron, the head of the Vatican's Council for Interreligious Dialogue.
The issue of interfaith dialogue is by no means an easily agreed approach. Everyone agrees that we must have a dialogue of some kind, and they have asked us to initiate it and continue with it. But exactly what the expectations are out of that dialogue is still undecided, as far as the churches go. What we are convinced of is that in our country, in our place, at this time in our history, we must live together as well as we possibly can in the space that God has given us.
Australia may not seem like the most obvious place to look for examples of progress or best practice in Christian-Muslim dialogue. Yet the General Secretary of the National Council of Churches in Australia, Reverend John Henderson, tells me his country is at the cutting edge of this effort, largely because of the increasing numbers of Islamic immigrants, adding to the already multicultural nature of this nation.
We don't want to sound arrogant about making ourselves a model for other nations, but we'd like to share our experience at least, because Australia takes a great deal of note of being a multicultural country. And in that multiculturalism, many people are recent immigrants. In fact, in the city of Sydney, I think one in four are born overseas, and a much higher percentage than that have at least one parent born overseas. And that they are coming from all over the world, including many Muslim communities. And so we are, in a sense, at the cutting edge of trying to make all that fit into a national identity and become a harmonious community. The role of the National Council of Churches in this goes back probably to the late 90s, maybe a little earlier than that, when we first started having more formal discussions, particularly with Islam, particularly with our Muslim neighbours, very conscious that there were difficulties that were likely to arise, rapidly escalated, of course, in 2001. And what we had already done by that stage was form very good fraternal relationships, if you like, and conversation. In 2002, we launched our formal dialogue, which we call the Australian National Dialogue of Christians, Muslims and Jews. Very intentionally, we decided to focus on those three faiths. There was quite a bit of pressure to take it broader than that, but we felt taking it broader than that might disperse too much the message that we were trying to do. And what we've really tried to do with that group, which operates on a shoestring with really very few resources, is try and set a model of language and the way we talk about each other and the way we respond to each other's issues. And it's a grassroots exercise, really. Although it sounds like a national thing, and that sounds very grand and very big, it's actually a very grassroots effort. So that when a particular group, for example, feels threatened or there is vilification or violence towards them, we are ready to stand with them, to walk beside them, to show that although elements in society may be targeting a particular group and vilifying them, the community at large, and specifically the other religious communities, are not part of that, but in fact stand in solidarity with them. If I can give you a case, an instance, in the city of Sydney at Christmas, not the last Christmas, the Christmas before, we had a series of, well, you'd call them riots, laid-back Australian style. They had riots on the beach. And there was a gang of young, I don't know that they were Christian, but non-Muslims. And there was a group of Muslims going to the beach. And they had this conflagration, and it escalated and resulted in some violence that spread to a number of other suburbs. And during that period, a church was burnt down. Now, we don't know who burnt it down, and I very much doubt that it actually was one of the protagonists in this event. Nevertheless, they were blamed. The Muslims were blamed for burning down a church in this period of tenseness. So because of the nature of our dialogue, it was an immediate response that we all went to the church, but we started at the mosque. Friday prayers took place, and we marched from the mosque to the church, where there were a number of speeches and it was widely televised, to say that this kind of event should not be permitted to separate us. Another thing that we tried to do, for instance, post-September 11, was to not, by agreement, not highly publicise vandalism of mosques, synagogues and churches, because we discovered that all three got vandalised, particularly our Eastern Rite churches. People couldn't tell the difference. They're so religiously illiterate that they targeted difference rather than specific difference. And we agreed at that time not to give satisfaction to the vandals, who were probably motivated by other things than religious zeal, that their acts could get them on television or on the news. So we agreed, actually, for a large... I mean, obviously police reports were made, but not to publicise that, not to speak to the media about it. And we think that worked because the attacks died down very quickly, much more quickly than we think would have been the case if there was vicarious satisfaction. So that's the kind of thing. It's fairly simple, it's fairly straightforward, and it's based on a good first-hand relationship and knowledge of each other. We also seek nationally to empower local groups We haven't got direct control of what happens in the grassroots. And I think dialogue best happens at the grassroots. I think the church happens best at grassroots. I'm sure mosque happens best at grassroots. Synagogue does as well. So we believe in empowering that which is happening locally and trying to set a national model for what's possible locally.
If we look at major events such as, for example, I'm thinking of the Bali bombings in which so many Australians were killed, in these kind of very much in the public arena, in the media, these kind of events which produce a huge outcry, national outcry, are you able to work in that context as well as just these more grassroots things you're talking about?
Well, of course, in that type of context, with our resources, your voice is easily drowned. And at that point, also federal and state governments become immediately involved, as does the international community. So the press attention, which is where you find a voice, tends to be drawn towards those big players. But in terms of the responses in country and on ground, then we are involved through our respective presences. We coordinate together, we talk together. And in terms of memorial services and responses in that sense, there is always a strong interfaith element in those discussions. However, in Australia, we did have the phenomenon post-Bali, which had never really happened to us before, of the government seizing the control of memorials and events and actually determining who the players were. And that then was a discussion for us between government and religious groups as to, in fact, who were the ones to be conducting memorials and running services, both in memory of the Australians who were killed, but of course of the many other nationalities, including many Balinese who suffered terribly and are still suffering, I should say, as a result of that event. And Bali is still feeling the effects very keenly. So yes, it's much more difficult under those. A tsunami would be another case in which it was you're simply overwhelmed by the attention and the What we are there for, however, is the long term. So very often the immediate event might not be possible to manage, but the long-term issues is where we want to sit.
What kind of relationship does the National Council of Churches have with the government today? In many cases, we've seen governments, if you like, trying to perhaps exploit these kind of church gatherings or church leaders in order to be seen to be cooperating when it's convenient to them, but not perhaps when it isn't.
Well, one tries not to be too cynical, of course, and you try to work with the opportunities as they present themselves. The National Council of Churches, for its part, has been a long-standing player, about 60 years, in Australia in terms of refugee policy, particularly in that area, but also international aid and development, peace and justice issues. Has a strong and, I think, good record in that area. Now, of course, I don't know quite what the listeners of Vatican Radio would know about Australia's policy in terms of refugees and other issues in recent years, but we have not been entirely satisfied with our government's approach. And in fact, we have been quite strong critics, in a constructive sense, of government policy in that area. And we have consistently sought change in government policy, we believe, to a more compassionate approach and also in line with our responsibilities under the Geneva Convention. So Australia has long separated church and state, of course, not in the American sense, but in the fact that there is no established church or religion in Australia. There is a sea change happening, not in relation to the establishment of a religion, but in the sense of the role of religion in politics. We're sensing a new growing environment here, which in fact is not necessarily to the benefit of religion, to gain more prominence in the religious, in the political arena. So we're treading with caution at the moment. However, all that said, I would say our basic relationship with government is very sound, very constructive, and is really just an ongoing dialogue. Within the realm of church as responsible players in a democratic society.
You're talking about relations also within the actual council itself, the different church leaders and so on. And I'm wondering how the difficulties between, say, the Catholics and the Anglicans or the other Protestant churches, how that is affecting this broader relationship with other faiths.
Well, of course, the council operates a bit under Chatham House rules, and that is internal arguments between the churches stay there. I mean, this is not just between churches, this is within churches. I mean, the Anglican Communion, as is widely known globally, has many issues, and those issues are reflected in the Australian spectrum in a very full and open way. Other churches that have a stronger authority structure, such as the Catholic Church, you're not as aware of the issues, but there is still subversion, and I believe that Australia has a bit of a reputation for being resistant sometimes or a bit independent. This is a fertile ground for dialogue, actually, and rather than being a problem, I think it creates opportunities. It certainly creates dialogue between the churches around their responsibilities collectively to the Australian community. The Iraq War would be a case in point, and I think to the last group, the churches and the church leaders resisted and opposed Australia's initial involvement in that war. And I spent some time in the US at that time and experienced the same reaction, but a very different methodology, if I could say. So the churches have their differences, and in that area, the National Council of Churches nurtures the conversation. But we don't act on it, because we can only act where the churches are asking us to act, where they are in agreement to act. Another case in point, which was very, I suppose, more local to us in Australia, were changes in industrial laws that were recently passed by our government called work choices. We feel under a reasonably unjust methodology of ramming something through Parliament so quickly that nobody really had a chance to get a fair view of the legislation and a response to it. There again, it was a remarkable, not the differences, but the unanimity between church leaders, churches, and the National Council of Churches across the spectrum. And I should add that our council does include the Roman Catholic, well, I use the term Roman because we have Eastern Rite Catholics there too, but the Catholic Bishops' Conference is a full part of the life of our council, so our actions include them. And in fact, it has been remarkable, what has been remarkable has been the unanimity and the common voice. And I think the ecumenical encounter creates an opening for that to happen, and that's why it's worth pursuing.
Do you think the ecumenical dialogue is further, if you like, enhanced by the urgent need to take this dialogue further to the Muslim world in particular at the moment?
Look, I can't answer that one in clear terms, because the jury is still out on that one. The issue of interfaith dialogue is by no means an easily agreed approach. Everyone agrees that we must have a dialogue of some kind, and they have asked us to initiate it and continue with it. But exactly what the expectations are out of that dialogue is still undecided, as far as the churches go. What we are convinced of is that in our country, in our place, at this time in our history, we must live together as well as we possibly can in the space that God has given us. And the religious groups are agreed on that, and the churches are agreed that that's the nature of our dialogue. When it comes down to issues of mutual trust, there is still some way to go. And for instance, 7 of our 17 members are Eastern and Oriental Orthodox churches, many of them coming in their countries of origin from Muslim-dominated lands. And there is still a strong hermeneutic of suspicion over any authentic dialogue with the Muslim community, because they bring with them their memories and their history of oppression or of violence or of issues. And this particularly comes from countries such as Egypt. I think they're probably the most vocal in this respect. So there is this hermeneutic. So when we do interfaith dialogue, we're always very careful to take an Arabic-speaking, Middle Eastern, Christian, Australian with us to help to allay that suspicion. But these are early days, I think. The National Council has it clearly in its sights that interfaith dialogue is something we are called to do by the churches. However, at this stage, the Council is still structured around its traditional activities. So finding space to enhance this interfaith dialogue is something we still have to challenge the churches with.
Aside from the history of suspicion that you're talking about, the tension lies both within the Christian churches and in the Muslim world, in the tension between spreading the faith and yet not trying to encroach and therefore crusade onto others' territory, if we want to use that rather inflammatory word.
Yes, I think it's the P word for us, proselytism.
Exactly.
That's a word that has often been quoted. I don't think that's become an issue for us locally in terms of our dialogue. I know that it has been an issue in Victoria, one of our states. And in Victoria, there is an anti-vilification legislation, which is unique in the country. Religious anti-vilification. We have laws nationally for racial and gender and other forms of vilification, but not specifically for religious. Victoria does. And a proselytising act was being carried out in a Pentecostal setting vilifying a Muslim community and trying to set up a strategy for a way in which you could conquer the evil Muslim. And that was the sort of language they were using, and very inflammatory. And there was a court case then brought against them of vilification. And the interesting thing was that most of the churches stood in defence of the Muslim community's right to not be vilified in this way, which I think was quite a surprise to many in the local community. That was an interesting test case for us to say that the churches, in fact, were concerned for the independence and freedom of the Muslim community to practice its faith against those who would proselytise towards them. So the actual issue of conversion hasn't been a big one in Australia. There are a number of Christians who've converted to Islam, many of whom came from a non-practicing Christian background, and there have been a number of Muslims convert to Christianity. So far in dialogue, no one's made an issue of this, because in Australia, faith is a matter that you have freedom to decide for yourself.
You talk about dialogue as being more about listening than about talking.
Yes, well, here I am doing a lot of talking and not much listening, so it has always been a challenge, I don't think just today. Of course, we live in a world that is crowded by words and language, and we're constantly being assaulted by written and verbal language. In dialogue, the first thing to do is try and create space. I think a safe space in which we can feel comfortable and feel comfortable with the other, and that requires careful listening. The difficulty is creating that, because we live in such an urgent world where there are problems to be solved, issues to be discussed, and actions to be fulfilled. And people come to dialogue meetings bursting with things that they want to see happen. We must do something about this. We must combat that. And very often we do respond. But if we neglect the first step of being together, not just doing, then we will probably in the end run dry and run out of energy for the exercise, because if you just want to do things, there are more efficient means of getting them done than dialogue. You can go and find like-minded people, set up a committee and have it done. You don't need to dialogue to get what you want. So that sense of possibility in that safe place is the biggest challenge to me in dialogue. Here I've been speaking about the role of the government in facilitating inter-religious dialogue on a regional basis. One of the challenges on this is government working in an area where the outcomes are so intangible, and realising that that intangibility is worth persisting with. We in the religious sphere are more accustomed to this intangibility and perhaps lack of definable outcome. I mean, we worship every week, and what would you say would be the outcome of that? So it's a new area for organisations like government to work in, I think. So we need to be very sensitive to both trying to help them meet what they want to see come out of it, but at the same time preserving the sanctity of the dialogue space.
My thanks there to Reverend John Henderson, General Secretary of the National Council of Churches in Australia. And that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, and from all of us here at the English programme for today. Join us again at this same time tomorrow, or find us on the internet, www.vaticanradio.org/English. For now, stay tuned to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.